bravely with several naval missiles in the Red Sea. The hit was direct and accurate, thanks to God.
Experts say that conducting two operations within hours serves as evidence that the US-UK aggression against Yemen has failed to undermine the capabilities of the Yemeni army or halt their naval operations. And instead, the ongoing Western aggression will expand Yemeni operations even further.
These operations are a message that the Yemeni armed forces are in a state of high alert. After targeting the American destroyer gravely, the U.S. thought that we could not carry out any other operation for 24 hours and tried to pass the merchant ship that was heading to the ports of occupied Palestine. But they were surprised that our forces targeted them. This is also a message that the American-British aggression has failed to limit the capabilities of the Yemeni army.
Following the Yemeni naval attacks, the US and UK carried out a fresh round of air strikes against several positions in the capital Sana'a and other cities. US officials said the attack was carried out using F-18 fighter jets launched from an American military base in Bahrain.
Observers highlight that the Yemeni naval operations go beyond displaying military strength, rather seen as a humanitarian, ethical and religious duty to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people. They assert that Western aggression will not dissuade Yemeni naval attacks, which are expected to cease only when Israel halts its genocidal war in Gaza. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Nicaragua has dedicated an avenue in its capital to the people of Gaza and Palestine. The mayor's office of Managua held a ceremony to officially name the street and a nearby park, which has been named Parque Palestina, in recognition and solidarity with the ongoing 75-year struggle against the Zionist occupation. In attendance were Nicaraguan solidarity groups and representatives of the Palestinian embassy, who together with the mayor of Managua unveiled the new street name.
Así, estamos muy contentos.
We are very happy doing this act in honor of the fighting people and their historical struggle and the unconditional bond with the people of Nicaragua. We are inaugurating an avenue with the name of Gaza, an avenue that is in our historic center of the city, and we are demonstrating that Palestine is there in our hearts, in the hearts of Nicaraguans.
Eso muy significativo.
It's very significant. This reflects the brotherhood and historical relationship between both peoples, both governments. In the midst of the Israeli bombing of our people in the Gaza Strip, Nicaragua has demonstrated many times its solidarity towards the Palestinian issue.
Earlier this month, the Government of Reconciliation and National Unity of Nicaragua filed a request before the International Court of Justice to join the case initiated by South Africa against Israel for the crime of genocide in Gaza, saying Nicaragua is determined to fulfill its obligation to contribute to preventing and punishing the genocidal acts that are being carried out in the Gaza Strip.
The children deserve to sleep in peace, women to live in peace. Palestinian families deserve to live in peace. That is why today we name this park with the great affection, with great solidarity with the people of Palestine.
This is not just any street. Pista Gaza is located in one of the most transited arteries in the historic center of Managua. Homage paid by the Nicaraguan people and their government with the just cause of the Palestinian people. Camila Escalante, Managua.
Across the United States, local governments are passing resolutions demanding a ceasefire in Gaza as pro-Zionism sentiment continues its historic crumbling under the weight of daily Israeli war crimes. The third largest city in the United States, Chicago, also has the nation's largest Palestinian community, which was thrilled to see their city council pass a resolution demanding a permanent ceasefire.
We were on edge, honestly, for a while, and the fact that it was passed is just an amazing show of solidarity with our brothers and sisters in Palestine. We know that it doesn't necessarily change anything for them on the ground, But I think that this will definitely put pressure on our government to hear the will of its people in one of the largest cities of America. And hopefully this will influence some of their policy, and we will get a permanent ceasefire soon.
Ceasefire demands have been approved from major cities like San Francisco, Detroit, and Atlanta to suburbs and small towns, which are insisting on taking a moral stand. Words like apartheid and ethnic cleansing, which were once heavily censored in public life, are now being voted into the public record.
And you would wish that people in positions of power do things, do the right things, because they are the right things, because they're the moral thing to do. That doesn't always happen, but in Chicago it's a little bit different.
The United States was the only member on the United Nations Security Council to vote against a ceasefire, and they have paralyzed the Security Council on the issue of the genocide in Gaza. As congressmen in Washington reportedly refuse to even engage with Palestinian activists, city councils have become the primary place with political power which will discuss the issue and reflect the historic shift in public sentiment towards Palestine.
It really shows that when you vote for progressive politicians, progress does happen. We not only saw a vote for a ceasefire, but we saw a vote for solidarity and community building as well. The ceasefire vote is not only for the Palestinian people, it's for all communities.
The local resolutions are mainly symbolic, but they aren't so local. They show support to Palestine and their allies around the world, and they prove to Washington that their unshakable support for Israel isn't shared across the country. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
In a display of solidarity, 36 members out of 50 in the Kuwaiti National Assembly have called on the government to urgently convene a session of the United Nations Human Rights Council. The aim is to address the ongoing atrocities in the Gaza Strip, a move driven by Kuwait's strong support for Palestine in the wake of the recent ruling by the International Court of Justice on Israeli genocide in Gaza. In light of growing concerns about the genocide committed by Israel in Gaza, Kuwaiti lawmakers have underscored the urgent necessity to address the suffering inflicted by Israel.
Kuwait's position has not changed since the beginning. That's why Kuwait has now asked for an urgent humanitarian session in the Human Rights Council because of what Israel is committing in Palestine. Kuwait has not yet led the way to file a lawsuit, but instead has given documented evidence against Israel to South Africa. The International Court of Justice decision is a first step toward a world that sees Israel as a criminal, not a victim.
A coalition of Kuwaiti and Arab lawmakers has proposed assisting South Africa in safeguarding Palestinians against war crimes. They affirmed Kuwait's steadfast solidarity with global advocacy for Palestinian rights and justice.
The judgment of the International Court of Justice against Israel has shown the world that Israel is committing a crime, but the judges did not make any concrete demands. That is why our Kuwaiti ambassador to the UN is working towards a conviction against Israel. We don't want the world to get used to the scenes in Gaza. Also, what made things worse was the U.S. decision to cut donations to UNRWA. This is an inhumane step by the U.S.
The Kuwaiti proposed initiative seeks to mobilize international support for Palestine while holding Israel accountable for its actions in Gaza. It underscores Kuwait's unwavering commitment to upholding human rights principles. This united stance displays Kuwait's determination to confront injustice and support the oppressed. It also serves as a strong message to the international community that there should be no impunity for those who commit crimes against humanity.
Kuwait's robust backing for Palestine is evident across different sectors in the country. And the new government here in Kuwait has prioritized actions against the atrocities that are taking place in Gaza by the Israelis. This is Farah Al-Hashim, Kuwait City.
Vowing to fight the common threat of terrorism and reiterating their commitment to improving bilateral relations, Iran and Pakistan are back on the right track to boost ties following tit-for-tat missile attacks on each other's border regions, where terrorist separatist groups have been active.
We are saying this loud and clear for the terrorists to listen carefully. Iran and Pakistan will not allow terrorists to create insecurity in the region. Make no mistake, we are one nation in two different geographical areas, and both sides strongly respect each other's territorial integrity.
In Islamabad, in response to his Pakistani counterpart's official invitation, Hossein Amir Abdullahian discussed ways to fight against the terrorists based along the Iran-Pakistan border areas that are, in his words, supported by hostile third countries. Many Iranian and Pakistani forces have lost their lives in recent years in the fight against terrorism, and over the past 2 weeks, both Iran and Pakistan inevitably launched missile attacks on each other's soil in order to contain the terrorist separatist groups, a move that created a media frenzy. And now this official visit is clearing things out.
You need to understand that in the last 70 years or so, Pakistan and Iran have developed a robust cooperation between themselves. We have strong people-to-people contacts. We have religious ties. We have historical ties. We have cultural ties between our two countries. And these ties are extremely important for our two countries to have a common security and common development, peace and prosperity for each other. I think the important thing for us is that there is a strong sentiment in Pakistan that peace and prosperity and security of Iran is something which is extremely important for Pakistan and for the region. And we have very strong reason to believe that Iran is also motivated by the same sentiment.
Views that were reiterated by Pakistan's Chief of Army Staff, General Sayed Asim Munir, as well as Pakistan's Prime Minister, Anwar ul Haq Kakar, who urged joint efforts, more coordination, and intelligence sharing to fight terrorism as a common threat to both countries, while also extending an official invitation for the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi to travel to Islamabad. Iran and Pakistan are turning a new page, and the Iranian foreign minister's trip to Islamabad is a sign that both sides are adamant in expanding their bilateral relations. Gisumi Shahmadi, Islamabad.
Students at Harvard University filed a civil rights complaint against the school for not protecting pro-Palestinian students from, quote, terrifying and unchecked harassment. As the devastating effects of the so-called Palestine exception to free speech continues to wreak havoc at campuses across the nation.
When there is anti-Palestinian bias, it's not addressed and it's ignored. But when there is accusations of anti-Semitism, everyone's involved, it's highlighted. And so we do see an extreme difference in that. If, you know, campuses across the country are concerned about anti-Semitism, which they should be concerned, and now at this point they're concerned about anti-Israel bias, why are they not concerned about Palestinian bias? Especially, Palestinians were grieving. I have students that have lost multiple family members. And then while they're, you know, having this anxiety and they have to study, they're also being vilified at the same time.
At the University of Illinois campus in Chicago, supporters of Palestine described how students and professors feel criminalized, intimidated into silence, and sense a threat of punishment for defending Palestine openly.
But I do think many, many faculty are just simply afraid to broach the topic because of their fear of consequences, whether that's, you know, people taking photographs of them, their lecturers videoing them and posting them on websites that will blacklist them, if they're being followed on campus, for example. That's something we've certainly had outside groups following students, following faculty, taking photos of them. And we don't know what's going to be used, creating dossiers on us and submitting them to administration. Like, these are all possibilities to repress pro-Palestinian advocacy and really sort of raise the intimidation and repression on campus.
When professors describe being openly stalked while on campus, which is supposed to be a secure area for students and teachers, The scale of the intimidation, hypocrisy, and injustice which Palestinians and their supporters are subject to becomes crystal clear.
You know, my experience is I've been followed on campus, for up to an hour at a time, just following and taking photos, not engaging, not saying anything. I've had my photograph taken while giving public talks, while walking on campus. And again, it's not clear how these documents are going to be used or what the purpose of the intimidation is, which makes it that much more intimidating because we don't know what is going to happen, what's down the line, what the future holds in terms of our safety.
Across the country, people have been punished for speaking out in favor of Palestine, and not just in academia. Death threats, lost jobs, and visits from security agencies have all been a part of the nation's largest Islamophobic wave since Donald Trump's so-called Muslim travel ban of 2017. The first solution at the University of Illinois and many other campuses is to overturn the intellectually false institutional policies which equate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. The goal of the repression is obviously to raise the costs of speaking out, but Palestinian activists say they will never remain silent about Israel's atrocities. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Among Israel's countless atrocities is its killing of journalists, which has passed 100 during the current onslaught on Gaza. South African journalists have come out in at least four cities across the country to commemorate their slain colleagues.
We gather not only to commemorate our fallen peers, but to confront the heavy toll of the conflict. Conflict, as what the media like to say. The tally of the human lives lost, the countless narrative left untold, and the voices forever silenced.
As the latest Israeli assault on Gaza has reflected the clear divide of the media, it is not objectivity, but truth that protesters are demanding. Veteran journalists who covered the apartheid struggle in South Africa say you cannot get any closer to the story than the journalists in Gaza. They note that only those who capture the realities as they play out on the ground fall into this category. In their opinion, journalists who are embedded with the Israeli media and have subjected their work to regime vetting have compromised the story. South African veteran correspondents also challenge the Western attitude towards the figures reported from Gaza, including the number of journalists killed.
What anyone who disputes the numbers is saying to us is that we don't trust the reporting because you're Arab or because you're Palestinian. Nobody whose office is in Europe can tell me that what my colleague in Ramallah tells me is not true. So there's that's the contradiction.
With at least one journalist killed daily in the ongoing Israeli aggression, South African media practitioners want international law to be upheld and an end to the killing of their colleagues. They say the death of journalists mean a blackout of truth. Hassan Seria, Cape Town.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. in the limelight.
The Zionist regime uses all means available, including confiscation of land, expelling Palestinians, relocating them to geographically defined areas, destroying and vandalizing Bedouin property and facilities, and declaring their land as nature reserves or closed military zones where grazing is prohibited. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, Abu Najeh al-Omari is an 80-year-old Palestinian man. He spends most of his time crying and bemoaning that he and his family were forced to leave their Bedouin community east of Ramallah. He told the Palestine Chronicle, we dream about it day and night. Several months ago, a group of illegal Zionist settlers, protected by Zionist regime army and police, forced him and his family to leave their house and their land. Al-Omari has lived in the Ain Samia area since 1960s. It is a vast, beautiful land surrounded by mountains, rich in water springs, and characterized by a particularly fertile soil. Al-Omari, a father of 8 children, worked as a farmer and breeder. His family was one of the dozens that formed a Bedouin community, which gained a prominent place in Palestinian society. According to Al-Omari, for decades, the Zionist regime attacks against them have never ceased. He told Palestine Chronicle that since 1967, Bedouin families in the area have been subjected to harassment and assaults, whether at the hands of Israeli settlers or troops. He lamented, from time to time, they would steal our livestock and prevent us from grazing them in several areas, sometimes under the pretext that it was a military zone, and sometimes that the grazing areas were under the control of the Israeli regime, and sometimes under the pretext that they were close to the settlements. He added, but we came here long before the settlements were built. These restrictions, however, deepen the relationship between Palestinian population and this land. The population has grown, and they began to cultivate the land with various crops in order to diversify their sources of livelihood. 5 years ago, the Zionist regime began to tighten its grip on them, preventing them from building barns for their sheep or to add rooms to their houses in order to accommodate a growing population. He said, every time I built a small room, the Israeli army demolished it. We built a modest school, but the settlers smashed its windows and cut its water pipes. Every Palestinian in this area is at risk of having his home demolished under any pretext they choose. With time, a group of Zionist settlers who called themselves Youth of the Hills began practicing pastoral settlement in Ain Samia area. The settlers brought their livestock, prevented the Palestinians from grazing, and gradually seized their lands. Last year, the frequency of Zionist regime attacks on this Bedouin community doubled. Zionist settlers and troops worked together to expel Palestinian families through non-stop assaults, beating residents, throwing stones at homes, constant cursing, cutting off water and electricity supplies, stealing livestock, burning and vandalizing agricultural crops, all came as part of an intense wave of attacks, which aimed from the beginning to forcibly remove the Palestinians. Al-Omari said, they stole 30 heads of livestock from me, claiming they were theirs, and stole dozens more from the rest of the families. We were afraid they would steal them all, so we had to leave the community to more distant areas, and so far, we have not been able to return. 37 families, each consisting of 7 to 10 people, most of them children, were forced to leave their homes in the Ain Samia area under intense pressure from the Zionist regime. In the form of relentless attacks by Zionist settlers, Israeli army and police, they left behind their homes with everything in them and were not able to return and even to collect their belongings. Anyone who dared to go back was beaten, abducted, or had his vehicle burned. We used to get our livelihood from livestock and agriculture, but now we live on aid. We do not live together as a community anymore. Every family was forced to live in separate villages and to sell their livestock. Every day I wish to return to Ain Samia, he said. Wad Salameh, 37, has been living in Wadi al-Sharq, Bedouin community east of Al-Khalil, for 10 years. She moved there after she got married. Last November, she heard the sound of footsteps near the house. When she went out to investigate, she caught 4 masked Zionist settlers pouring inflammable liquid and setting the house on fire. Salameh told the Palestine Chronicle, I started screaming, but my husband was not there. I quickly grabbed my 4 children from the house, and we managed to run away before getting harmed. But the house and everything in it turned to ashes, despite the neighbors' attempts to extinguish the fire. Salameh and her family were forced to live in a small rented room in the neighboring town of Sar under very difficult financial circumstances, as they had lost all of their savings due to the fire. The burning of the house was not the first incident in this community. Almost daily, Palestinians record various attacks from settlers who want to force them to leave. Salameh said, they came every night and threw stones at us, protected by Israeli army. They destroyed everything. They cut the electricity and water pipes to make our lives more difficult. According to the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics, 25,000 to 30,000 Bedouins live in the West Bank. The Bedouin way of life is now threatened by the severe restrictions on their freedom of movement imposed by the fabricated regime of Israel. According to the center, their presence hinders Zionist settlement plans in the West Bank. Al-Baidar Organization for Defending Bedouin Rights monitored, during last October alone, the deportation of 10 Bedouin communities from areas of Ramallah, Nablus, Al-Khalil, Al-Quds, and the Jordan Valley. Hassan Malihat, the organization's general supervisor, told the Palestine Chronicle that the Israeli regime is committing genocide against the Bedouin communities in the West Bank. The Bedouin presence in the West Bank is concentrated in the eastern deserts, specifically in the areas east of Ramallah and Al-Quds, in the Jordan Valley area, in the Ariha and Tubas areas, as well as south of Al-Khalil. The latter is classified as Area C under the Oslo Accords. Therefore, it is subject to the security and administrative control of the Zionist regime. Malihat said, these lands are the backbone of the implementation of Israel's settlement projects, and the Bedouin presence in these areas is considered a real obstacle to the implementation of these projects. Therefore, the policy of ethnic cleansing is practiced by demolishing homes, confiscating property, and forcibly displacing the local population using illegal and racist means. The Zionist regime uses all means available, including confiscation of lands, expelling Bedouin residents, relocating them to geographically defined areas, destroying and vandalizing Bedouin property and facilities, and declaring their lands as nature reserves or closed military zones where grazing is prohibited.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The death toll from the Israeli aggression on Gaza has topped 27,100. That's an average of 230 Palestinian lives lost every day for 120 days. A war of aggression that has killed more than 12,000 children and thousands of women. A war of aggression in which the aggressor keeps getting armed and supplied by the world's biggest military-industrial complex, while the people facing the aggression are denied basic humanitarian assistance in their struggle to survive bombings, famine and starvation, and the cold weather. Stay with us as we'll discuss the situation in the besieged Gaza Strip with our guests tonight. From Montreal, we have author and political activist Eve Engler. And human rights activist Mohsen Naqvi is joining us from Houston, Texas.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Engler in Montreal. The total death toll from Israel's 119 days of incessant bombings and attacks has passed the 27,000 mark. In our intro, we just covered that that's an average of 230 Palestinians killed every day for the past 4 months. Over 66,000 people have been injured. Schools, mosques, churches, hospitals, and ambulances have been frequent targets of the strikes, which have left only a few medical facilities partially operational. Now, please share with us your perspective on the horror that Gazans have been enduring for the past 4 months.
It's beyond belief. It's hard to wrap one's head around just how barbaric Israeli policy is. Obviously, those who've been the luckiest in Gaza, those who, you know, haven't been killed or haven't been seriously injured or haven't had family members killed, they will be traumatized probably for their whole life over what's taken place and what they've seen and what they've been in the middle of. So it's just a incredible collective trauma, a collective abuse of 2.2, 2.3 million people. It's just remarkable that this can happen in an age of instant video, instant communication, where we see the horrors so easily, yet they continue.
Mohsen Naqvi, since the beginning of the onslaught on the by the Israeli regime, they've sought to dismantle the resistance groups in Gaza. But after 119 days of the deadly attacks, the resistance groups, we see, are fighting back strong both inside and outside of Gaza. Hamas representative in Lebanon has also said that Israel has failed to achieve any of its objectives in Gaza. So what have the Israelis achieved altogether, other than being record holders for murdering children?
The Israelis have miserably lost this this war. May that be diplomatically, may that be the media war, the war of narratives, and more than anything, they have lost the military war. There is absolutely no doubt about that, because not a single military objective of the Zionist regime has been achieved up to now. The one military objective that they have spoken about from the very beginning, which they use as a pretext of this war, was the dismantling of the resistance forces in Palestine, was the dismantling of all Palestine freedom fighters, including Hamas. They have failed to do that. We are seeing videos on different groups, on different channels, on Telegram, on media outlets like the Electronic Intifada, Breakthrough News, and it is quite clear how proficient the fighters in the Al-Qassam Brigade are, it is in the Al-Aqsa Brigade are, and how these different factions of freedom fighters in Palestine are collectively, systematically, and strategically defeating the Zionist regime in Gaza. It honestly, now in today's day and age, it doesn't really matter how conventional media portrays the success of the resistance, because people know the truth. The truth is on social media. So it doesn't really matter what Israeli newspapers or mainstream media funded by the Zionists is saying, because the world now knows the truth.
Mr. Engler, is Israel, in your opinion, using the excuse of eradicating Hamas, something that our guest in Houston also agrees with, that it has failed to achieve, to continue to kill Palestinians? The UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine has said in the past, just a couple of weeks, what Israel is doing in Gaza is the monstrosity of our century. And now we see Israel is even bombing areas of Gaza that it has designated as being safe, wiping out entire families. There's much more intent to this than just being collateral damage when the scope of death and destruction is considered.
Yeah, it's definitely not just collateral damage. This is a policy of collective punishment, a policy of driving people out, genocide. Now, I think there is an interesting question about whether the aim of Israel is really to eradicate Hamas. I don't know that the more sober-minded people in the Israeli establishment would believe that was a realistic aim, or that they could have success in fulfilling that. So the question then becomes, is the rhetoric about we have to eradicate Hamas, is that rhetoric really just a way to justify genocide? And I think there's certainly a significant amount of reality to that. I'm not sure if Netanyahu himself is so deluded that he believes he could eradicate Hamas or kill everyone in Hamas. They clearly, as my co-panelist has pointed out, the Hamas is still able to fight and still able to blow up Israeli tanks and still able to kill Israeli soldiers. So Israel's ability to keep control of Gaza is seriously in question. It doesn't look very good. So from an Israeli perspective, that dimension. But no, I think that it's very clear that Israel's rhetoric about Hamas is part of basically justifying genocide. And with regards to the genocide, even, I mean, it's horrible what they've done. But I think that there was, and there still is, you know, the Israeli government that wants to drive Palestinians out of Gaza and want to put a whole lot of pressure on Egypt and some other countries to, you know, to take Palestinians out of Gaza. That's also, they haven't succeeded on that front either. So they seem to be caught in this pattern of just, you know, killing children and women and random men and not succeeding militarily.
Right. Mohsen Naghvi in Houston. How important has the unified response been from the resistance fronts in the region? There's Lebanon's Hezbollah. There's Yemen's Ansar, the resistance movement, and the armed forces of the country. Resistance groups in Syria and Iraq, which have also carried out operations against Israel and the United States' positions as well. Do you think that the Israelis and Washington were not considering the repercussions of a coordinated and unified response from all resistance fronts in the region?
I think the unique strategy and the unique aspect about the resistance is that element of surprise. Time and time again, the resistance has surprised its opponents in war. We saw that. We saw how Hezbollah surprised Western proxies in Syria. We saw how Hashid al-Shaabi surprised Western proxies like ISIS, the Empire's proxies like ISIS in Iraq. And I think once again in this conflict, we see resistance forces constantly surprising their opponents. No one expected the Ansarullah, the legitimate government of Yemen, to enter this conflict in the way they did. They've really gone headfirst into this conflict by targeting U.S. cargo ships, by targeting cargo ships of any country that is in any way supporting Israel. Hezbollah obviously was expected that Hezbollah would involve themselves in this conflict, but I think the fact that they have limited their involvement to the extent of Lebanese borders, and as Sayyid Nasrullah said himself, that they are strategically attacking the facilities of the Zionist regime. This was also something that the Zionist regime did not predict. They predicted a more heavy response from Hezbollah, which was also, it added up to that element of surprise. And then we see Kataib Hezbollah, we see the factions of Hashad really going headfirst as far as their involvement in this conflict is concerned by attacking, constantly attacking, military bases of the U.S. in Iraq. So definitely, and I think more than anything, and to say the least, the fact that resistance freedom-fighting forces within Palestine, in Gaza, in the West Bank, we see them fight as one unit, which we haven't really seen before. So the way, the strategy that the resistance front has adopted is something that it is without a doubt was unexpected off of its opponents, and that is one reason why we're seeing the resistance front victorious against the U.S. empire and their allies.
Mr. Engler, condemnations are pouring in over some countries' suspension of funding to the UN agency that supports Palestinian refugees, UNRWA. Also, 28 aid NGOs have voiced deep concern over the decision taken by the likes of the U.S. and the U.K. and some other countries, warning that the reckless decision may lead to the complete collapse of humanitarian response that will impact the assistance for over 2 million civilians. What was your initial reaction to hearing this decision? And what do you think are the motives behind such a move?
Well, I think that the first element was that this was Israel trying to take away from the discussion around the International Court of Justice ruling that they're plausibly committing genocide, and what was essentially saying that they need to cease their genocidal policies. Which was relatively, you know, considering the court, relatively strong ruling. And so they announced that this business of 12 UNRWA employees, and this was a way of, you know, involved in October 7th, and this was a way of shifting the discussion away from the ICJ ruling. So I think that was quite clear. I mean, the timing was, and then the Americans immediately suspended funding. Canada followed within, you know, hours, and a number of other countries followed suit. So this was, there was, I think, a very important public relations element to this from Israel's perspective, the U.S. perspective. But I think that also, at a bigger picture, they, you know, they want to make life so miserable in Gaza that it's, you know, uninhabitable. And UNRWA is important in delivering services and getting some food in and, you know, the basics. And so, obviously, undermining UNRWA or destroying UNRWA or destroying the ability is you know, serves Israel's purpose. Israeli officials have been pretty open about this in recent weeks, going back multiple weeks before this, you know, the funding was suspended, that they wanted to destroy UNRWA. And so that's part of it. From the standpoint of someone sitting in Canada, though, or the U.S., as a Canadian, you know, when the reaction of the Canadian government to the World Court saying that Israel basically needed to cease its genocidal policies, the Canadian government didn't even say, not even a perfunctory statement saying, well, Israel's bound legally by that ruling. Instead, the same day, they severed money to UNRWA. So, I mean, they just basically made it absolute crystal clear that they are part of enabling Israel's genocidal policies. It's an outrage beyond, you know, I'm quite cynical of the Canadian government. I've seen Canadian foreign policy being, you know, brutal in many different places, but I was myself stunned by being so crass that on the day the International Court of Justice ruled that Israel is plausibly committing genocide, that the Canadian government's reaction was to, okay, well, how can we help that genocide by cutting off funding to... refugees.
Mohsen Avi, same question to you. In reaction, of course, to the ICJ's ruling, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called the order a disgrace and vowed to continue the onslaught. But that was to be expected because the Israelis, they've been a rogue entity since day one. What about the Western countries that back the Israelis, these self-proclaimed beacons of democracy? The ruling should have brought them in check to stop their support and stop their arms deliveries to the Israelis. They had to be thinking twice about the pressure that this ruling would pile on them, as well as if they continue to support this massacre. And as our guest in Montreal just mentioned, they turn around and cut funding to UNRWA, which is a UN agency that supports Palestinian refugees. The first country that comes to mind is, of course, the United States. What's your take on that?
It's absolutely despicable. When ICJ came out with their landmark judgment, a majority within the Congress were critical of the ICJ, saying that this judgment was without any merit, and so that in itself reflects upon the kind of representatives we have in Congress, but it also goes on to represent the power of Zionist lobbyist groups who literally control the U.S. government. The likes of AIPAC, for instance, the kind of influence they can pull on U.S. senators, representatives, and congressmen. So it's when we talk about fairness and justice, we don't see that reflecting upon the U.S. Congress. And that's why there was a congressman who was questioned by a protester, an activist, in which when he was asked as to why, how can he pull out his funding or can he vote for pulling out funding for UNRWA while there are kids being killed in Gaza, to which he said, no, there should be more restrictions. He said, I will fight for more restrictions. We shouldn't. Everything is about Hamas to them. They're almost blinded by the massacre that U.S. tax dollars are committing in Gaza. So it's quite clear that when it comes to ethics or basic human morality, that does not exist. When you are a politician here in the U.S., it is all about pleasing your Zionist lobbyist financiers over representing the will of the people of your country. And this is an issue that needs to come in the forefront of U.S. politics, where there needs to be limits on the actions of lobbyist groups. Lobbyists should not control the policy of this country, but rather its representatives should reflect upon the intent of the people they represent. Because it's quite clear, millions have come out in solidarity for Palestine. Millions are coming out protesting against Al-Bad systems, against the role that the U.S. government is playing. There have been strikes outside Blinken's office. There are people doing protests outside government representatives because of their direct involvement in this conflict. And I wouldn't be exaggerating if I was saying that the U.S. is a direct party in the genocide of the innocent Palestinians.
Mr. Navi, I'm going to stay with you for this next question. The Yemeni army, it says it has targeted a British commercial vessel in the Red Sea, which was bound for Israeli ports. Yemen has pledged to continue its operations against Israeli-linked vessels until the regime stops its war on Gaza, regardless of the attacks by the U.S.-led coalition in the Red Sea. Talk to us about the Yemeni response to the Gaza onslaught and the defiant message that the Yemenis are sending to the U.S. and its allies.
I mean, think about it. Yemen is a country that has been under famine, that has been under Saudi bombardment for years, right? It's fairly a new government. It's an unstable country. Yet when it comes to resistance against the Zionist regime, they are at the forefront. If the countries of the Gulf, the Arab so-called Muslim countries of the Gulf, took similar actions, we wouldn't see the genocide that is happening in Gaza today. I, in my opinion, the Yemenis are doing everything within their power and beyond to try and limit any kind of support that the Zionist regime is getting or receiving. When you limit support to Zionist Israel, that is how you force them or corner them towards weakening them and calling for a ceasefire.
Right.
So the Yemeni actions are actions that are commendable. These are heroic actions that everyone else should follow, looking at what they've done.
Okay, I'm sorry to jump in there, Mr. Navi. We're short of time. I want to get one quick final word from Mr. Engler as well. Briefly, if you may, sir, in spite of all the efforts to weaken the resistance in the region, an effort